Hello, hello, Charles. Welcome to the stage. So, friends, thank you for joining us today. I'm so stoked to welcome Charles Boskoski of Arena. This is PRISM. This is our second event series of our collective intelligence exploration. I'm Caroline, I'm your host. And again, we're joined today by Charles Boskoski, one of the many co-founders of Arena. Charles, I want to thank you right away just for your kindness in being here because I literally pestered you for months, I think, repeatedly, and you somehow thanked me for my persistence, which just then encouraged me. So, a little side note to all of my friends out there, never give up on your dreams, persevere.
No matter how big or small,
Yes, that's right. So, hello to all of our friends who have joined us. We have an intimate space today, but if this is your first Twitter space, I want to point out there's a pinned tweet at the top of the screen here, and I've attached some goodies to that. So throughout the conversation, you might hear me refer to this pinned tweet and just click on that, and I'll guide you to where you should be looking. So let's get started. I really want to set the space here with Charles. We're going to be talking about collective intelligence tools for wisdom, and we're certainly going to circle around this, but I think a lot of the times we'd be taking sort of a tangential approach. And this has to do with the value of slowness. And Charles, you've written beautifully about how impactful, how needful slowness can be, or put otherwise, I really like the phrase in the fullness of time, like how healthy and humane it is to recognize that growth, whether it's the growth of Arena, the company, or the growth of one's knowledge and wisdom, it calls for this patience, it calls for this fullness of time, and how so much of the trappings and the design of our current online spaces really work against this. So I would love to have our conversation be guided today by this value of slowness and emergence. And if I'm being really honest with myself, I think the conversation that I want to have with you, Charles, it kind of a lot of these questions puts me in a sort of in-between space. I feel like you and Arena are working in a very rare and special manner, not just rare in like the tools for thought space, and we'll get into your lack of affinity for that phrase, Charles, but and not just in the broader tech space, but just rare period. And I feel like we don't really yet have the words to articulate some of these explorations, which I feel are so important for humanity at this time. So with that, again, Charles, I'm beaming so much gratitude to you for being here today. Can we start off with you introducing yourself and Arena? And the question that I'm sure you love by now, what is Arena?
It's so funny. Yeah, after 11 more than 11 years of doing this, I still don't have like a great quick explanation of what Arena is. So I'm Charles Ruskoski. Yeah, like Caroline said, I'm one of the co-founders of Arena. We call Arena, what is even the, I'm like, now I'm blanking on our official tagline. It's a platform for connecting ideas and building knowledge. And the way that functions, actually, so I have a channel on Arena, which maybe will go part of the way of explaining it. So a channel is like, start back one more. So on Arena, we have two things, two units. One is a block. A block is kind of like a file, it can be a text, an image, a link, a PDF, kind of anything. And a channel is a particular arrangement of blocks, and channels can be connected infinitely to each other. And that's the entirety of the data model of Arena. So channels can be public, meaning like anyone can see it, but only I can add to it. They can be private, meaning only I can add to it, or only people I deem as collaborators can add to it. And then we have channels that are open, which means that anyone with an Arena account can add to them. So I have a channel on Arena called How Do You Describe Arena at a Party? And if I were at a party, if I was trying to explain it quickly, I would probably just say, oh, it's like a nerdier version of Pinterest, or like a nerdier version of Tumblr, something like that. Like skirting around the issue by associating it with something that someone might be already familiar with. But then when we get into it, it's usually like they're like, what type of people are using it? What would I use it for? And then I would talk about like all of us are on the internet all day long, or even if we're not on the internet all day long, we're kind of inundated with information. There are pieces, there are times within that time frame of being inundated with information where you get something that actually comes with you that you might think is interesting. And like, what do you do with that? You know what I mean? So part of it, I think, is about like, okay, now there's this space where you can start to put things into a place, build a context around those things that one might find as interesting. But also the other part of it, I think, part that we're, what's the word? I want to say like, I guess the word is adamant. The part that we're kind of adamant about is that it's a person like building up for themselves this muscle of recognizing those points in your day when you're coming across some information that is particularly resonant with you. And that's something that like a piece of technology, a piece of software maybe can help you with just by like being the vehicle through which you do that thing. But that is a thing that one does themselves. And it's a very like human kind of thing. If that makes sense.
No, definitely. I love that, Charles. And for folks who may not be familiar with this channel that Charles was referencing, What is Arena? Just refer to the pinned tweet at the top and you'll see in this thread at the very beginning, that subtweet, I've linked to a couple of screenshots of some of the really beautiful and evocative ways that some of the members of the Arena community are describing their experience there. So Charles, you mentioned in a previous interview that you loathe the term tools for thought. So you'll notice that this space is called Tools for Creativity.
Oh,
I hope
you.
That lands a little bit better.
Works.
So you characterize Arena as a platform for connecting ideas and building knowledge. And you also point out that Arena is not so much oriented around productivity. So beyond this point, is there something else specific about the term tools for thought? Or how the space is generally conceived currently that creates this friction or disconnect for you? And how would you reframe it?
Yeah, it's a really good, I mean, I feel like part of it is just this like Charlie Chaplin thing of like, I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member or something like that. But I think it's because this notion of tools for thought is so oriented around productivity. It's like this, like in like classical startup-y language, you know, you have this like problem statement. And I mean, I guess I kind of did it at the beginning too. Like you're inundated with information all day. What are you going to do with this information? But this tools for thought space, I think it's so oriented around like you're reading like the Greek classics and you're going to connect these ideas to your ideas about working out. You know, it's something like that where it's like the point actually isn't to like, the main point isn't to make something out of this stuff. It's to like enjoy interfacing with it. And I think that's kind of the distinction. So it is, I mean, it is a tools for thought. And we have like used that kind of shorthand to describe it before. But I think the way that this space has evolved, I think like there's some difference, there's some like nuanced difference in philosophy, and that like what we're interested in is like nerding out at the library or like a used bookstore or something, when you're just kind of going around and letting your instincts or your intuition guide you towards the things that you might be drawn to. Whereas I think the tools for thought space, yeah, I mean, again, I think orientation around productivity or that like you're going to do something with this stuff and not just enjoy it is kind of the difference. But it's a subtle distinction to make. And I don't even think that my argument right now is landing, but like, I think that like when you're on Arena for a while, you do kind of get the distinction, you know.
I want to pin you down at this point, Charles, and ask, is there any team or project in the Tools for Thought space that you think is kind of vibing with this nuance? Because I'm curious. I think Arena is super special, and I'm curious if you're getting a sense that there are other teams that are working in this direction.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't want to talk shit.
If there's someone that's doing it right, tell us.
So, I mean, weirdly, the first thing that comes to mind when you said that is the tool Linear. And that's, they would never describe themselves like that as being in Tools for Thought. But I think because it's a tool that kind of has an opinion, but it stands in the right point between like being opinionated about how it should be used, but also taking a step back and letting people organize things the way that they want to. Those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in. Like where does the tool stop and the sort of like human convention begin? And so like just to frame it the other way, not, I mean, and trying to avoid talking shit, like the thing that I don't like is like the thing that I'm a little bit scared of, I guess, is this sort of like trend towards automatic categorization. And I think like and especially when you orient these kinds of tools around productivity, the it sounds like a good idea to be like, all you have to do is just throw it in this place. We will categorize it for you, and all of your stuff is here, and it's just a search to find the thing that you want. And I think when you don't have that step of like of taking a moment to think about the thing that you're looking at and thinking about the context that it should belong in, you miss out on all the like on all the actual benefit of doing this thing, this real human framing, context setting around a particular piece of information. So yeah, I'm interested in tools that are geared towards being more open-ended.
I love that. This is a related exploration, Charles. So Maggie Appleton has pointed out this sort of unfortunate narrowing conception of tools for thought. She has written about this from an anthropological point of view. And her thesis is essentially how, quote, tools for thought is now being predominantly conceived or even captured through the lens of computation, software objects, and note-taking apps. And Maggie's point is that there's an entire intellectual lineage exploring how human cognition might be facilitated or expanded that is just really being ignored in all of this, right? The work of cognitive scientists, philosophers, artists, teachers of religion and meditation. And so Maggie's saying that if we're locked into the framing that tools for thought are computational objects necessarily, then we seem to be pushing in the direction of greater interface complexity because the thinking is the structure and the content of our thoughtscape is of exponential complexity. So if we're going to represent this somehow, this needs to be visible in the architecture and the bells and whistles need to match this complexity. But Arena's UI is very simple, and the rule set, as you explained it to us earlier, is very simple. It's deceptively simple, and I say deceptively because it's easy at first glance to discount Arena for that reason. One is tempted to maybe think, oh, the simplicity is like constrained possibilities. Oh, is this all there is to it? But it's, in my experience, it's precisely the opposite. So, Charles, can you share your process of ideation and thinking around the design of Arena, around the simplicity, which I think really is rare and exceptional in the world right now? And maybe a more evocative phrase than simplicity would be like an embracing stillness. This is like the quality that I experience when I'm surfing the rabbit holes of arenas. I feel like I'm being held in this sort of embracing stillness or comfort. So, what were the major nodal points for you as a thinker, as a programmer, as an artist? What were the key influences in your life that figured into this unique design approach to Arena?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when you were talking about it just now, I was thinking like, I mean, this practice that this sort of practice of like taking things from the world and rearranging them has been going on for, long before computers. There, people had commonplace books and they were just, I mean, they were literally like arena channels. People would cut out quote, write down quotes, cut out pictures from other books, just arrange the world in the sort of way that they saw. And I think like the benefits of that and the benefits of Arena are almost identical. You know what I mean? But it's a sort of thing where it takes like a person doing it. You know what I mean? It's like, what is the software doing? What is the tool doing? And what is the person doing? And having that balance between like the software has a specific role, and the role shouldn't really. It's like, it's actually something that needs to be. People need, especially around this space, people need to take greater care in what the software is doing and what the person is doing, in my opinion. But to answer your question, so I came from my first experience with a tool like this was with Delicious. Delicious was around in like the early to mid 2000s, and it was the first, I think it was the first software to like, the first major software to use tags and like a word cloud. But basically what you did on Delicious was, instead of saving bookmarks to your browser, you would save them to Delicious, and it was just like a little bookmarklet thing. You could add tags to the things, which were essentially just, you know, categorizations of the thing that you were saving. But what I thought was really interesting there was not the tags at all, but just having like this sort of running list of the things that I was deciding were important and being able to look back. I mean, the only way to see it was reverse chronological, but you just looking back at that sort of like trajectory of like, oh, okay, a month ago I was thinking about this or looking at this thing. And now, like, seeing the steps after that, I can see how that led to this. And seeing that sounds really simple. It was just, like, kind of, you know, I hadn't, yeah. I mean, speaking about the sort of, like, idea of productivity, my impression of it before using it was, like, oh, this is some kind of, like, nerdy organizational tool. And I wasn't into the idea. But seeing that process of seeing how my thoughts could unfold felt really valuable to me at the time. And I was also more interested in making art than I was in making software. And then the other part of that, I think that was really special, was just you could look at a particular link and see the other people that saved it. So like a handful of my still best friends now I met through Delicious. And it's just a function of like, we saved the same link, which is really wild. So I mean, those two things are extremely simple and they're not complicated technically, but like, it's like how you apply. I think that software in particular was inspirational to me and to a lot of people who came up around the same time as me, because it's like how you orient technology, not necessarily like doing something that's the fanciest, you know.
I want to circle back to something you said. It was very evocative for me. You said about 5 minutes earlier that there's a specific role for the software, and you encouraged us to take more care in regards to thinking about the role of software. And I feel like there was something there that was unsaid that would be important for us to hear. Because, like I said, I think I'm not sure how you think about this, but and maybe this is a misconception, I think it's pretty rare to have in one person someone who is a technologist, a programmer, as well as an artist, and can bring those two aspects of their mind and their self into balance. And I think I read that you had your first website when you were 11 or 12. Yes. You've been building sites and programming for a long time now. And when you say to us that we need to take more care when we are thinking about the role of software, can you unpack that a little bit more? What are you seeing that shows that people are lacking that care or that forethought or that intentionality? And where do you think that lack of care is rooted in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I think that there's like a lot of angles to approach this question. So like part of it is that the way that sort of mainstream software is built and the way that it's funded, it's, you know what I mean? It's going for mass adoption. Mm-hmm. And the way that you go for mass adoption is, if you think about like Coca-Cola, you know what I mean? It's extremely unhealthy, but it's like very tasty and very addictive, you know? And the things that are a little bit harder, like, I mean, I'm just like making a guess here, but I would guess that more people drink Coca-Cola than there are runners, you know, like the things that are like healthier and a little bit more difficult are often like the things that require a person to do a little bit more are often slower to reach mass adoption. And the way that I think most software is funded, the way that like the last 20 years of the internet has unfolded, is like we're going for speed and scale, and both of those things in tandem are, the expectation is for like quick and easy and convenient. And yeah, you will get a certain flavor of software when those things are the predominant factors at play. Yeah. So I think, I mean, when I say that we should take more care, I think like it's really hard, you know what I mean? I run Arena, but I also recognize that we have to maintain our social media accounts as like one of the only channels. To my thinking is that basically there are people out there who would be more comfortable on Arena than they would be on Twitter or on Instagram. So it's worth keeping up these channels so that we can reach those people at some point. But the job of doing it is difficult because it's extremely addictive and it's really distracting. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm just thinking like, or my point is that like, even for me as someone who's saying this, like I recognize how hard it is for like a mm-hmm. person in the world every day to just like resist these sort of like, what's the word? It's hard to resist the temptation of like falling into content rabbit holes, you know, and like falling into these patterns that are set out for us. So I mean care in terms of a person and how they experience the internet and what they use the internet for, but also care in terms of like what type of patterns are we helping to encourage by building software a specific way, you know. And the bottom of that, I think, always, because no one has figured out in a great way to make a software company into a cooperative, there's always going to be a business at the bottom of it. So it's always about the motivations of the business and how those motivations are aligned with the people who are using the software. Sorry, it's kind of rambly. It's a little all over the place.
No, yeah. I was following and I'm grateful that you could unfold that for us. So one thing that I've noticed in your response and also while prepping for our conversation, like when it comes to thinking, when it comes to the life of the mind, like the magic and the power is really in the inarticulable and the inarticulated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what Arena has shown me, like less is more. Like you were saying, there's a deep benefit of leaving something to the imagination when it comes to the UI, yep. which is that the human being is called to be much more active. And I want to connect this with a talk that you gave in 2019. And for our friends who are in the community right now, if you could refer to the pinned tweet at the top, I think it's the third tweet down. So in this talk Charles gave, I think it was in 2019, you were applying physical spatial metaphors to social networks. And you were encouraging us to discern the patterns that are healthy and conducive to vital communities. And you've said a few times now that you would want Arena to be like the public reading room at the New York Public Library. Right. So I want all of us to get in the mood and to be in that room right now. So I've attached some really beautiful, lovely pictures for folks who have not been to New York and have visited this landmark of what it looks like in this reading room. And I've also attached this beautiful passage. I think it was in the New Yorker where she's describing the feeling of being in that reading room. And just for kicks, you'll see a fourth picture in that subtweet. And this was actually a mock-up of a proposed renovation to the library. Wow. That was completely shouted down and defeated by New Yorkers. So thank God. Goodness. Yeah. Yeah, right. Thank goodness. But just seeing those pictures in juxtaposition, along with this passage from the New Yorker, which I encourage all of you to read, it really is truly beautiful. And then in the tweet following that, I'm also for shits and giggles, I've included a video that kind of reminds me of what a spatial metaphor would be for an online space that is optimized exactly for what Charles has just talked about. Online spaces, social networks that are optimized for scale, growth, and Pavlovian triggers, right? And so it's a completely different feel. Yeah. It's a completely different experience. And in looking at the two, you could say that there is a certain humanity in the video of the casino, but it's completely a different quality of humanity. And I think, again, this is like we're getting into that inarticulable quality of this conversation that I'm skating around that we don't really quite have words yet. But there are certain ways that you can trigger human beings to be active. And then if you look at the picture of the library above, there are ways to, as I've kind of expressed before, to envelop the human being in embracing stillness while facilitating the active mind and the active pursuit of ideas. So it's two very different qualities. And I think it's very powerful for us as a community to think about that.
Yeah.
So Charles, I really do think it's incredible that Arena manages to evoke this quality of the reading room. It manages to do so much with seemingly so little. And I have two sort of additional theories about what's behind the magic here that I want to pose to you. So yes, it's certainly the thought and the intention behind the design that calls forth this simplicity or this experience of embracing stillness. But I think a second element of this magic has to be the community. Yeah. And I'm looking at some of the icons here, and I'm seeing Chakra, for instance, in the space. Hello, my friend. Hi. And I know she's been very, very critical to me discovering Arena. So I want to hat tip Chakra and just the Arena community in general, because I think this has to be a critical element of this magic. We can allow ourselves here, Charles, a non-cringe discussion of that C-word community and other words like competitive moat, because when I think of the pleasure I get from exploring Arena, it just wouldn't be possible without the quality of thought that has found its way there. Like there's a devoted, avid pursuit of ideas and questions that makes Arena what it is. For sure. Beyond the design, beyond the UI. And I think it's actually this thoughtscape that is collectively created, that is the counterpart to the majesty of the ceilings, the physical architecture of the New York Library Reading Room. So immediately what any good business person wants to know is, how do I duplicate this? How do I copy this? And I think the answer to this is related to my hypothesized third element of the magic of Arena, which I think is the unique mix of the founders, of whom you're just one. So I don't think you can replicate building this sort of community easily, because I think, and here I'm going to hat tip the name of this event series, Prism, I think the Arena community is an organic outgrowth of a very definite, specific group of collaborators who have come together and honed in on a timely, vital idea. And now through that group of collaborators, that idea is able to ray forth and refract as if it were white light passing through this prism. The various colors divergent, but harmonious and ultimately coherent. And I think the ability of the collaborators to come together in this fashion is quite rare and special, because it calls for so many things. Each person has to have a mutual context. They have to have certain experiences that support and complement the experiences of their colleagues. They have to have the ability to deeply listen and communicate with nuance. They have to have the ability to creatively express themselves. All this is conducive to deep empathy, not just with one another, but to the vital idea at the center of the business, right? Because I think the vital idea at the center of the business will thrive or wilt based on the empathy that exists or not within that group of founders. So Charles, and I think I may be on the right track, but again, I invite you to tell me that I'm not, because you mentioned once that what's special about Arena is that all of the founders have backgrounds in the creative arts, that you tend to approach these problems that you're tackling from a cultural perspective and not just a technological one. And I think that this is what is so important. This is what is missing in the tech space in general, in the tools for thought space in general, and what precisely makes Arena, forgive me, a unicorn, like a truly a rare unicorn, so to speak. So that's my theory, Charles. Can you shoot me down? Can you tell me where I'm wrong? Can you just share more with us about your thinking and your experience about the exceptional community on Arena and how that community is related to the special cohesion among the group of founders?
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That's extremely generous. I mean, I have some theories, but I think they only go to explain part of it. I mean, we're obviously extremely lucky that we have the people who are on Arena are just like kind of still shock me every day. And it like it's a little overwhelming to think about, to be honest. But so part of it, I think, is because there's two parts to this thing and they're kind of like interwoven. One is that when you're showing these pictures of the difference between the reading room and the casino, what I see there is this thing of being open-ended. Like the reading room at the library is not telling you what to do. There's a bunch of people there that are kind of hanging out and working, and you come into it and think like, oh, okay, this is what I'll do too. But within that, you've got your own thing going on. You know, you're doing your own kind of work. Your thoughts are oriented in your own specific way. And then you join that group of people and you're also like doing your own thing, but all together. And by contrast, in the casino, it's like, it's not open-ended at all. What you're supposed to do is press the button. So, I mean, part of it is that it's like, it's open-ended. It's intentionally open-ended. And I think the type of person that can like deal with that open-endedness, like it's a little bit uncomfortable at first. And we hear this all the time where like someone will come on Arena and say like, I just, you know, signed up and left. And then 2 years later, it just like totally made sense. And I came back and now I'm really into it, which I totally get. And I'm, you know, I'm also not sure if I didn't have the experience that I had, if I joined Arena now, like what, how long it would take me to get into it. So that's one part. It's a certain type of person who can get over the hump of this like expanse, this expansive space of being open-ended. And it's also, I think, like, because we're so small and we're not like a, you know, we don't have a gigantic engineering team, there are quirks to using the software that wouldn't come from like, you know, a big corporation. And also it's a certain type of person who can get over those quirks and deal with the sort of like rough edges. And over time, like if we weren't so interested, if we weren't like interested in Arena from a cultural perspective or from a creative perspective, if we were just approaching it from a business, we would have given up a long time ago, because it took a really long time for it to be sustainable and profitable. And so I don't think there are like a lot of software companies that would pop up like that. I mean, there are, but those are like the really special, nice niche communities that you find hidden in other places around the internet, you know, and they keep going, not because it's an amazing business, but because they're like obsessed with their people that are around them and the ideas and all that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, it's being open-ended. It's having the community grow really slowly over a long period of time. It's like, it's the sort of like positive side towards a little bit of friction in the software. And then, I mean, the other thing is just like, when we started, our only goal was like that our smart, interesting friends, the friends who are much smarter, much more interesting than us around us, would use Arena without it being like a favor to us. And when we got to that point, you know, it was like 100 people using it. It felt like, cool, we're done. like this is all we actually need. And that's what, like that sort of like seed, that foundation of people is what, like where the community emerged from. And there are certain people on Arena now that I'm like, oh, I know we could like go back in the lineage of invites and like find the, you know what I mean, the original person. And like, and it's cool. It's really cool. And so I think there are like parts of, there are like family trees there that are just like really interesting groups of people that, yeah, it's like, it's extremely nice to be around.
I love it. Charles, I'd love to switch gears here and dig into some of the influences of Arena. A few are explicit influences that you have mentioned, and one is guessed at, but I'll have you confirm that. Okay. So you've mentioned before, Charles, that David Bohm, the physicist and philosopher, is a key influence for you in building Arena. And so forgive me, this question is going to be like tangential. So it's one of these things that I feel is a little bit hard to articulate. Yeah. Thank you, my friend. So one of the first things I read of Bohm was the book Science, Order, and Creativity. Mm-hmm. I've read that. Yeah. He co-authored this with David Peet. And they were concerned to show that scientific creativity did not proceed in the manner that was theorized by Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher of science, mm-hmm. of scientific paradigms fame. So Bohm argued that there's always going on a subtle process of evolution of thought, even though it may not be noticed or articulated consciously by scientists. And there is this beautiful moment in the book where he's asking, how can I give the lay reader a sense for how a scientist pushes that evolution along, how a scientist actually leaves of and creates a new theory? And he approached this through the metaphor. He referenced Shakespeare and his plays, which are rich in metaphors, you know, like Macbeth, which has the line, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. And the metaphor, Bohm said, brings together two disparate, sometimes completely incompatible things, mm-hmm. and connects them and even makes them related or even completely equivalent. And Bohm said that it's this paradox of connecting or making equivalent two disparate things that kicks the mind into a very special mode. And he described this as, he characterized this as the mode of nonverbal meaning making. And I think the nonverbal part is absolutely key. Bohm wrote, quote, "The first sense of the inner significance of a poetic equating of very different things is a kind of tension or vibration in the mind, a high state of energy in which a creative perception of the meaning of the metaphor takes place nonverbally." So I was later reminded of what Bohm wrote, this passage about metaphors, when I came across an interview of yours in which you were asked, "Charles, is there anything in particular that you do to get yourself into this magical zone of being deeply investigative and interested in something?" And you answered, quote, "I recently learned Einstein used to do something specific. To get his brain in the zone, he would bring together two very different things to see what the connection was between them. Arena at its best is really good for that," end quote. And so it clicked for me at that point, Charles, that Arena is the metaphor as computer interface. It's disparate blocks appearing to be separate or even incompatible being brought into relationship or even equivalency with one another. And in that act, the mind is thereby helped into a higher cognitive mode that is nonverbal, and for that precise reason, deeply rich and creative. And I think the act of the metaphor of bringing together two disparate things and relating them is something that I think relates very powerfully to this idea of collective sense-making, crisis of sense-making that we're in, because we see exactly polarization, unprecedented polarization. It's almost as if the blocks on Arena were to say, you know, F you, I want to have nothing to do with you, you're that, and I'm over here. The disparate blocks want to remain disparate and separate and unconnected and unrelated. And they want to have nothing to do with each other, because like you said, Charles, the open-endedness, the UI, the sort of ethos behind the product, it does take much greater effort on the part of the user or the member of the community, the member of the software. It takes effort that liking something or sharing something or retweeting something, that same effort just is not called upon. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to begin, like you said, to exercise that muscle. But I'm so curious about this, Charles, and I'd love to hear more of your thoughts and experiences on this, on the power of metaphor and on nonverbal ideation. I don't know if this was something that was explicit in your mind. Is this why Arena has been observed by many to be very attuned to, like, visual thinkers, you know, working with visuals and images? I'd love to hear you riff more on this if you can.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it was, I mean, honestly, where do I begin? So yeah, it's a certain type of person who I think this kind of practice comes easier from. But I have to say, like one of the big inspirations for that practice for me was Damon Zucconi, who's, I think he's here. Hi, Damon.
Hi, Damon.
Damon is one of the other founders of Arena, but Damon has like long had this practice of like, I don't even know what I would call it. And I also don't want to, like, it's a little bit of like trying to describe a joke or something. Like, I don't want to take the magic out of it by putting words onto it. But I mean, when I first came across Damon's work before I knew him, it was also like coming across his website and coming across like just like an Apache directory of images and PDFs and files and everything. And I was just like, oh my God, this guy is like looking at so many interesting like things, and they're all related in some way, but it's really hard to pinpoint like how they're related and what, like you can get a sense, you can see a pattern over time of like where his perspective is oriented, but it's really hard to describe. And I think the process of doing that, when you can trick your mind into doing that kind of thing, like there's a couple of channels that I have on Arena. I have a channel called Worse is Better Too. And it's really, I can't describe what the thing is, what all the stuff adds up to as a whole, but I certainly know when I see something online or in the world when it belongs in that channel. And I think that is a practice that comes more naturally to people who are to doing creative work. I don't think that it's like a practice that's inaccessible to anyone at all. I think it's like, it's a muscle that sort of anyone could build and build upon and exercise. And the interesting thing about it is like, to use your prism metaphor, you can start to like look at things from a lot of different angles, you know, anything in the world. And you can start to be curious about things in ways that you might not have been curious about them before, just having like a singular perspective. And when you're thinking in those terms, you can like, I don't know, it's not so much of a categorization thing as it is like that, like everything in the world, every piece of information, every idea can exist in multiple contexts, and the context really changes the individual thing. But you know, it's so hard to describe. There's multiple ways to come at it. You can think about it from the context perspective, and you can think about it from the individual piece of information perspective, and both are really interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you bring up the Bohm thing, because he was a protege of Einstein, so he must have gotten that idea directly from him. But another thing that he says, and the way that he describes Bohm dialogue, which is, you know, maybe it's too long to get into now, but he's basically saying that in this process of Bohm dialogue, he wants multiple people to be able to hold an idea out in front of them as if it were separate from everyone. So everyone can hold this idea in front of them and a space in front of them, and we can all look at it from these sort of different perspectives and talk about it from different perspectives and separate ourselves from it a little bit. You know what I mean? And start to talk about the different qualities of the thing. And that's, I mean, it's all very like, I wouldn't say it's woo-woo, but it's really hard to describe. But when you do it, you kind of get, I wouldn't even say a benefit, but it's just, you know what I mean? It's just, it's really interesting.
It is. It's, and I think it's so needed at this time, Charles, like I'm glad that you brought up sort of the intricacies of the Bohm dialogue framework, because I think, like David Bohm, ARENA is trying to help us to work with the sense-making crisis in terms of it's trying to help us become more objective about our own thought. Like you said, this dynamic of looking back on your history of searches and interests and seeing how your thought has developed over time just had this really significant impact on you. And so in an essay that you wrote, I think it was called On Motivation to Celebrate ARENA's 10th Anniversary last year, I think the first quote, what was the first quote, Charles? Do you remember? It was this beautiful quote about if anything is, it has to be personal. If anything, can you say it? Can you say it for us?
Yeah, it's from, the funny thing about that quote is it's spoken by Meg Ryan in the movie You've Got Mail.
A classic.
Yeah, a classic. The quote is, whatever else anything is, it ought to begin by being personal.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that. And so I want to get a little bit personal here and ask you a little bit about sense making and the sort of crisis of sense making that has brought you to the stage today. Like, what is your thinking? What are your experiences around how computers and online spaces are specifically contributing to or relate to this crisis of sense making? What do you think is the way out? And I know we've been circling around this question already. Are you feeling optimistic about this crisis? Are you deeply worried about it? And if you're feeling optimistic, what is it that has you feeling hopeful? If you're feeling deeply worried, what is it that has you feeling deeply worried? And then what do you do to keep grounded and balanced in this climate, which is so challenging for the individual and the collective in terms of making sense and making meaning? I know that was a lot to throw at you.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think there have been a couple of moments like this, moments in time when people are, I'll back up and say, there have been a couple of moments like this in the time span that we've been working on ARENA, where people have had this sort of like collective sense of wanting to reevaluate like what they want out of software, what they want out of social media, all this kind of stuff. And it's funny because in those moments, I start to feel really optimistic because the ideas that we talk about with ARENA and why we build ARENA and all this kind of thing become much easier to describe when everyone is like, being on Twitter is like a nightmare. Like when we first started, it was extremely difficult to describe to my parents what ARENA is and like why there's like needs to be a different approach to social software. But now it's much easier. And so I think, like, because, like out of these sort of like moments of crisis when people are really like feeling fed up, my take is that it's really good because you really start to think about it. You know what I mean? People really start to think about it, and the conversation mm-hmm. gets more involved, and like people come to different conclusions. I think the hard part is that my take is one thing is that the first thing that people go towards when they talk about social media and what needs to happen is either like it needs to die completely or it just needs to get really small. So, you know, there was like a moment a couple of years ago where people were like, it's just going to be, you know, group chats and like really tiny Discords. I mean, I think that the problem with those approaches is they're still like taking it on from a sort of system and technical approach when really this problem is like a cultural and social one. And it's not so much like decreasing the audience size as it just is like reorienting what exactly we're supposed to do on the thing, you know? And when you have platforms that are only meant to be performative, that's exactly what's going to happen. So I think there just needs to be, I mean, so generally, to answer your question, generally, I'm kind of more optimistic the more that, like, ironically, the more that things get, like, kind of bad on social media. But mm-hmm. I think that, like what I think is the next step is actually going to be kind of hard because it will require a lot of, like, cultural adjustments and adjustments of expectations of people of what they're going to get out of these things and like not being wrapped up in the sort of drama that comes from being on social media. And yeah, that part is the hard part, the sort of individual part. But the problem becoming more understandable by most people, I feel like we're like on the edge of that. So yeah, that makes me feel good.
I would love to speak about another possible influence on you and Arena. I actually wasn't able to find any explicit writings or references of yours on the web, but I'm guessing that the philosophy of calm technology, as articulated by Mark Weiser and John Seely Brown, has played a role. Am I correct?
I'm aware of it, and I think it kind of came up around the same time as we were thinking about it, but yeah, it's too parallel. You know what I mean? Two approaches
yes.
is the same thing. Yeah.
Awesome. So I want to connect some ideas here and then end with you exploring the inarticulable again. You know, one comes from Ted Nelson, the creator of Xanadu, and we have a tweet from him in the pinned tweet, friends, if you want to look at that. But he was a key influence for you and Arena, and he had this concept of parallel page and invisible connections. And he described this very evocatively as a blow to the paradigm of sequential text. He said specifically was that, quote, a literary medium of parallel pages won't eliminate sequence, but loosens the paradigm of sequential text. So this idea of loosening the paradigm of sequential text, or I think loosening this paradigm of linear unidirectional thinking, I think it has a powerful resonance with certain ideas that animate Arena, including what you've characterized before, Charles, as fuzzy thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think by this, I'm guessing that you mean thinking and ideation that, again, is more visual or imagistic. It's not as severely demarcated in sharp conceptual lines, but it retains fluidity, the ability to metamorphose from one form into the next. Mm-hmm. And this fuzzy thinking in turn evokes for me the power of the metaphor. Mm-hmm. We discussed earlier the power of the sort of nonverbal creative tension that happens when you juxtapose two disparate things or blocks, as they would be called in the Arena interface. So if you take all of these previous ideas of loosening the paradigm of sequential text, fuzzy thinking, the metaphor, and you put next to them this idea of calm technology, which the paper is linked, my friends, in the pinned tweet at the top by Weiser and John Seely Brown, and I think this was in 1995, they had a very powerful concept in that paper, Designing Calm Technology, and it was a concept of empowering the periphery of human attention. They said that tech by now is very well versed in empowering the center of human attention, but we are disregarding the far more powerful aspect of the mind, which is the periphery. And in fact, they write, quote, we believe calm technology may be the most important design problem of the 21st century, and it's time to begin this dialogue. So what exactly do they mean by the periphery and the center of attention? They write that designs that in calm and inform meet two human needs not usually met together. Information technology is more often the enemy of calm. Can we really look to technology itself for a solution? Why is one technology often enraging, the others frequently in calming? We believe the difference is in how they engage our attention. Calm technology engages both the center and the periphery of our attention, and in fact, moves back and forth between the two. We use periphery to name what we are attuned to without attending to explicitly. And then elsewhere in this piece, Charles, they write provocatively of the periphery. Thus, the periphery is informing without overburdening. Mm-hmm. And it seems almost nonsensical to say that the way to become attuned to more information is to attend to it less. So again, I had to read that pretty quickly. I encourage everyone in the community right now that's listening to go read this paper, because I think it's super powerful and resonates a lot with what I love about Arena. But I said to Charles at the beginning that we would be venturing into territory that I, for one, hardly know how to articulate. So I think this concept of the periphery is a prime example. I have the sense that this working with the periphery, that Arena is helping us to work with the periphery of our attention and our minds, schooling the movement of attention from center to periphery and back again, is not only key to its calming nature, this sort of embracing stillness, this sort of being rooted in the New York Public Library reading room, but also a key reason why the community is so fervent in its love for Arena. I want to end it there, knowing that it's really hard to articulate what the periphery is. And I don't know if you would want to riff on that, because I'm super curious. I'm super curious what's coming up for you right now.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for, it kind of feels insane to me that I haven't read this paper before, but thank you. I'm going to read it today. what comes up for me is what I kind of described earlier, which is like, I have this chain, all worse is better too. I wouldn't know how to actually describe what the thing is, but I know when I see something in the world that it belongs mm-hmm. there. So part of it, I think part of this notion of like deciding what the software does and what the person does is like part of what's cool about Arena, or how some people can use Arena, is like, I'm doing that. I'm keeping those channels in my head running in a background process as mm-hmm. this sort of like pattern filtering thing, like all the time, not just when I'm on Arena, but like, it's like happening in the background. And something meets that like very fuzzy criteria, it's like that channel is with me, and the decision to put it there happens before I'm even on Arena itself. You know what I mean? So I think that's what comes up for me when I think about the periphery. It's like keeping, it's grabbing your attention. One, like having the motivation to keep the things that they're oriented towards, like with them at all times, even if they're not interfacing with the software. It's about like maintaining this like curiosity and interest in these sort of like fuzzy subjects. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
I love this so much. When I was thinking about this in prepping for the talk, I was thought this movement from periphery to center, it's dancing with ourselves. It's speaking with ourselves. It's developing our intuition, which sensitizes our attention to these nodal points. And I wrote in my notes that this is literally the bloodhound of our fate or our destiny. This is how, when we sensitize our attention in this way by using tools like Arena, and then we go out into the world and our attention is now able to hone in on the things that have resonance for us. This is literally how our life emerges and unfolds. And it's because of this attentiveness, this quality of attentiveness, that really gives shape to all of this like inundation, this flood of stimuli. What is it that's important to me that I'm going to focus on? And so I would love to leave it there, because I want to be respectful of your time. And I want to express really deep gratitude to you, Charles. Thank you for allowing me to pester you. Thank you for joining us on the stage today. And I want to thank each and every single one of the folks who are here in this community listening. You could be many places, but you chose to be here. And I think this is a really important conversation for us to be having at this time. So thank you all for joining us, and keep your eyes peeled. We will be having more events coming up soon in Forefront's Collective Intelligence Event Series. And with that, again, deep gratitude to you, Charles. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much, Caroline. That was awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. Everyone have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.